Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
2 things we learned from the president yesterday. The attempted terrorist attack on Christmas was a failure of understanding, and he will not turn the country into a fortress.
We will not succumb to a siege mentality that sacrifices the open society and liberties and values that we cherish as Americans. Because great and proud nations don't hunker down and hide behind walls of suspicion and mistrust.
The problem can be fixed, the president says, with better data collection and better analysis. But will that make Americans feel safer in the air? People might feel more secure inside a fortress. Fighting the impulse to build a barricade on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, January 8th. The takeaway for me is, you know, regardless of what the president says and how many times he says it, however forcefully and eloquently, people will probably still feel afraid when they step into the airport.
I think you're right. It's probably fair to say the president is also feeling the sting of all the security
aftermath.
Christmas Day bombing. But let's get to the headlines. It was all about accepting the blame yesterday at the White House. President Obama ordered improvements in security following that failed Christmas Day terror attack, but he refused to point fingers.
I am less interested in passing out blame than I am in learning from and correcting these mistakes to make us safer. For ultimately, the buck stops with me.
But there were also some bucks stopping with counterterrorism advisor John Brennan, who said he took responsibility for the failure.
I told him that I will do better and we will do better as a team.
Brennan also explained that the review of the incident showed Al-Qaeda's plans were very well developed.
That we had a strategic sense of sort of where they were going. But we didn't know they had progressed to the point of actually launching individuals here.
Meanwhile, the Nigerian man charged in the terror attack will make his first court appearance today. Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab is facing 6 charges. With so much evidence stacked against him, experts say his defense team is left with few options as the case moves forward. Todd Zwillick joins us now. Todd, you were at the president's press conference yesterday. You listened to the president speaking. But we didn't get any specific new policies outlined during the conference. So what was the purpose of his speech?
Well, I think, you know, throughout this entire thing, right after this Christmas Day attack happened, of course, as you know, Celeste, the White House was accused of being on its heels, and Janet Napolitano will probably go down for her entire career as having said the system worked after this. Well, ever since then, the White House has made pains to show that, no, the system didn't work, and the president, almost every day on the latter part of his vacation and since he's been back, has been taking actions and speeches and appearing before cameras to show, no, the system didn't work. I think it also, you just played the clip, John just played the clip. It gave the president the chance to say that most presidential of phrases. Goes back to Harry Truman. The buck stops with me. I think it was important for him to tell the country that he is very much on top of this, and the report has come in. He's ordered changes.
Okay, and he said that many times. Is that kind of his way of cutting through red tape?
Well, he certainly snapped the heads back of a lot of people in his administration. John Brennan, the special advisor on Homeland Security and counterterrorism, didn't just take responsibility for it. He said to the press, I told the president that I let him down. So he seems to have opened a lot of eyes.
All right, Todd, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. In other news, the wife of the Jordanian doctor who killed 7 CIA employees in a suicide attack in Afghanistan says her husband was outraged over the U.S.-led invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. She said he was also upset by the treatment of Iraqis at the Abu Ghraib prison. She spoke with the Associated Press.
In the next half hour, we're going to get the latest unemployment rate. The Takeaway's economics contributor from the New York Times, Louise Story, told us that economists are divided on what the latest figure is going to show.
Their estimates range from a decline of 100,000 to about a growth of 85,000 jobs. But right in the middle, the median forecast is flat.
We'll get that report when it comes out in about a half an hour. Let's look at the market. The Dow gets underway at 10,606. The S&P opens at 1141 and the NASDAQ at 2300.
Coming up, we'll talk about movies as we do every Friday today. Teen movies, who's making the good ones today? And in a few minutes, we'll get more information about the president's crusade to streamline intelligence sharing. But we're asking you, in order to make our skies safe, do you think profiling is okay? And who should we be profiling? Does it work? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at atakeaway.org. Well, the buck stops with President Obama. He took responsibility for any intelligence failures that led up to the attempted terrorist attack on Christmas Day during his speech yesterday. But he also ordered intelligence agencies to streamline how these threats are analyzed.
The U.S. government had the information scattered throughout the system to potentially uncover this plot and disrupt the attack. Rather than a failure to collect or share intelligence, this was a failure to connect and understand the intelligence that we already had.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick back with us. You were at the White House yesterday. And Todd, a lot of people said prior to yesterday's speech that this was a failure of sharing information, of communication. Sounds like the president saying that's not what the problem was. He says the information was there and it was shared, but it was not properly analyzed and then applied. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's right, Celeste. And the president and his deputies stressed that this was not like the failure that led to 9/11. You know, right after 9/11, when all of the analysis in the 9/11 commission was done, you had this Washington phrase called stovepiping. And stovepiping just means all of the information is in silos and it doesn't cross between them. Information's not shared. They said this was really not like that. Information was shared. The different intelligence agencies had access to all the information that the other ones did, but it wasn't prioritized. They didn't know what was the most important. Things got buried, and they weren't able to follow the leads that were the most important to say, hey, this guy has gone from Nigeria to a place where we know an Al-Qaeda cell is operating. He is getting ready to travel.
So wait a minute. So from silos to manure pile, it sounds like you're saying there.
Oh, come on.
I don't know if that's positive.
I mean, that is a classic Hockenberryan phrase, but John, I think it's accurate. I think you hit it on the head. I would maybe quibble with your metaphor, but I think it's right.
You won't be the only one.
We often quibble with his metaphor. Okay, thanks so much, Todd. Let's get some deeper analysis on this by Emil Nakhle. He's a former senior intelligence officer with the CIA and author of the book A Necessary Engagement. He retired in 2006. Good morning, Emil.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. You heard the president's speech yesterday. You just heard us talking with Todd Zwillick about how the White House feels this was not the same problem that led to 9/11. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I do. In fact, there are two questions here. One is that unlike 9/11, now we have a huge intelligence bureaucracy that was created after 9/11, and that, two, we did not have the expertise to analyze all the available intelligence. So I do agree with the president on that.
So you're saying that we actually, in trying to fix the problem of 9/11, which was that we were not sharing information between agencies, we then created this new bureaucracy to help us share information, but that caused the problem that led to the attempted terrorist attack on Christmas Day.
Yes, partly. So the other part, as I said, is that deep expertise that we need to have in order to analyze that information after we have shared it. I think I would like to make another point before we start into this, and that is I think we should always remember that there have been a lot of successes that have not been made public, but unfortunately one screw-up, as the president said, creates a tremendous havoc, and rightly so. But I think we should put it in perspective, but the expertise bothers me a lot, the lack of it, that is, bothers me a lot in this case.
Well, it appears to bother the president too, Emil Nakhle. Let's kind of get down in the nitty-gritty on what we read in the report yesterday. It sounds like there were three specific areas where the intelligence broke down. The first let's talk about is this failure to connect these dots.
Yeah.
What exactly happened? What caused that failure?
Well, the dots, the so-called dots, I really kind of don't like even the whole discussion focusing on the dots, but these pieces of intelligence that came to the agency and to other agencies about this fellow. Now, Omar Farouk al-Muttalib is a Nigerian kid, a rich kid, whose father went to the embassy and talked about his concerns about his son's radicalization. Now, this is what we call in intelligence a walk-in, that somebody walks in. And we oftentimes receive these walk-ins with all kinds of information. Well, in this case, this was special walk-in. It wasn't just a normal guy. He was a rich person, very well distinguished person, told us about his son. We should have taken note of that. Secondly, we had heard, of course, and there was intelligence that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was planning an attack against the United States using somebody, a Nigerian. Again, that's another piece of information. A third piece of information that this person was going to plan an attack against the homeland, not against an embassy or a U.S. personnel overseas. And that's another piece of information.
Okay.
So by not connecting all of these together, we failed to keep that kid from getting on the plane in the first place. And that is where the serious failure occurs.
Okay, but the thing that seems to concern you the most, having looked at this report, is as you said, the analysis of it.
Yes.
In what way did the analysis not work for us? In other words, you just laid out some very specific information
right.
that wasn't used properly. Where did the analysis fall down?
The analysis fell down in at least two areas. One, that we had underestimated Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's not only intent, but operational capability. We had all kinds of intelligence showing or telling us that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was active and was not only active in planning and collecting information, but also in operational capability. We had ignored that. That's very serious area of failure. The second is that the person himself that we had heard that a Nigerian was going to be used, and we kind of did not connect the Nigerian with this name. Unfortunately, a misspelling even in the name occurred. So because it was spelled in different ways, that name did not make it to the screen.
And unfortunately, getting better analysis of information is a more difficult problem than fixing misspellings, although they both have serious impacts. Emil Nakle is the former senior intelligence officer with the CIA. He was there until 2006. He's also the author of the book, A Necessary Engagement. He joined us from his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thanks so much for joining us. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
Latest jobless figures for December will be out in about 15 minutes. The Associated Press says most economists don't think the losing streak in the job sector is over just yet. A majority of economists surveyed by Thomson Reuters thinks unemployment will be 10.1%, up from an even 10. Is Jay Leno about to be recrowned king of late night? NBC is reported to be contemplating a plan to send him packing back to the 11:35 p.m. Slot he held for 17 years as Tonight Show host. That would send current Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien host to 12:05. We'll have more on this shortly.
Overseas, a bomb has exploded in Northern Ireland, seriously injuring a police officer. It's the latest in a series of incidents targeting police officers. Experts say it's likely to have been carried out by dissident Republicans hoping to derail Northern Ireland's peace process. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, who had a good week and who had a bad week?
Hey Jude, don't make it bad.
Take a guess there.
I'm a little confused.
Yeah, well, we're going to explain it all in just a minute. We're going to start a new series, Good Week and Bad Week. And in that is going to explain all about how the Beatles' Hey Jude gave somebody a good week.
Oh, this is this business with The Week magazine.
The Week magazine. We have this new series, Good Week, Bad Week in the News.
All right.
More on that in a few minutes.
Are you a good week or a bad week?
Don't be afraid. You were made to.
Hey, you want that to go?
All right, our first news takeout is a big media story, and it comes with a question, so let's go with me here. What if you were in a room, okay, with, like, Conan O'Brien, right?
Right.
Jay Leno, Jimmy Fallon, and Carson Daly? I mean, how funny would that be, huh?
That's hilarious.
Well, nobody would be laughing this morning, that's for sure.
Yeah,
NBC is apparently reshuffling its late-night deck one more time. Joining us now, Bill Carter, media correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Bill.
Hi, John.
Leno is going back to late night from 10 o'clock. The prime time experiment seems to have failed. Is that the story?
That's correct. It looks like they've decided that because the Olympics are coming up, it's a natural time for them to make a change, which has been they've been kicking around for several months now because of pressure from their local affiliates. They're doing so poorly at 11 o'clock following up Jay's 10 o'clock show.
I mean, basically, the promise of the network to the affiliates is always deliver us a great audience for our local news so we can make money. And Leno just absolutely bit the dust on that.
Yeah, that's really been the problem. I mean, once he was installed five nights a week, there wasn't even a single night that NBC could give them a really positive audience from 10:30 to 11 that would give them a boost. And so local ratings at almost every NBC affiliate were down by 15 to 20%.
Now, you know, NBC Universal has gone from the GE umbrella over to the Comcast umbrella. Does that have anything to do with the timing of this decision or the angst with which all of this seems to be handled?
Well, I was told it didn't. Now, Comcast, although they have made a deal to purchase, NBC has not officially done it,
right,
and has to keep an arm's length agreement right now. They can't really enforce their will on NBC technically. Whether or not they influence this in some way, I guess it's only something you can infer at this point. But they officially, they can have nothing to do with it.
Now, the sort of speculation that I see all over in the various stories that are running on this Leno thing, if Leno goes back to 11:35, Conan would go to midnight, and then Jimmy Fallon, what would happen to him? Carson Daly? I mean, what's going to happen to all these various programs?
Well, the wrinkle here is that Jay would only do a half an hour show and would go from 11:35 to 12:05, and Conan would then start at 12:05. He would get an hour, his regular hour, and then Fallon moves back a half an hour, begins at 1:05. The interesting thing, other interesting wrinkle, is that the Conan O'Brien show is still called The Tonight Show.
Right.
And Leno would have a show at 11:35, presumably still The Jay Leno Show.
And there's some deal in Conan's contract if he isn't doing The Tonight Show, you know, like Jihi has to basically give him, you know, the nation of Australia or something.
Yeah, $45 million, I think, was the penalty fee if he didn't keep didn't get The Tonight Show. But I think it's even more than that, because if they were to not have him do The Tonight Show, I think he would be free to leave. In
wow.
this case, even if he gets another offer, they would argue, no, you still have The Tonight Show. That's the deal you had. I think it would become a very big legal wrangle, and I'm told right now, at least at this moment, Conan is not ready to fight that fight.
Well, so if you were in a room with Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Fallon, and Carson Daly, no one would be laughing, right, Bill Carter?
I think Jay might be a little bit happy. He's going back to the time period where he was a winner from a time period where he's been a loser.
All right. Bill Carter, media correspondent for our partner, The New York Times.
And he has a shortened work day. He only has to work for half an hour,
right? That's right. That's right.
It is Friday. That means it's time to take a look back and see who had a good week, who didn't. We're starting a new series today,
right,
and we're interested in hearing from you, actually. We want your nominees on who you think had a good week or bad week at 8778-MY-TAKE. But we have this list from The Week magazine. They're our new partners. Puts out its own good week, bad week feature every Friday. So we're going to start, John, with the results of a survey. There was a survey by internet security firm Symantec. It released a list of the top searched terms by kids in 2009. Okay, here's Marianne Merritt, Norton Internet Safety Advocate, to explain.
The top five searches by children at onlinefamily.norton are number one, YouTube.
Okay.
Then Google.
Right.
Facebook.
Okay.
Sex.
Ooh.
And porn.
Yikes.
Did you catch the last two? That would be sex and porn, number four and five. This list applies to kids aged seven and under, as measured by software that monitors kids. So what do you think, John? Bad week for
moms?
That's a good guess, actually. That would have been my first. But actually, bad week for innocence, says The Week magazine.
I'll go along with that.
And, you know, it really wasn't all that easy to find a good week for anybody last week. But here's one idea.
I know the song, but
right,
I'm a little
confused. Right, this Hey Jude by the Beatles, a bunch of people sitting around, a big hit on YouTube where you saw them all sitting around in a floor. Good week for...
Wait a minute, sitting around on a floor. Oh, these are the people who were stuck at Newark Airport.
They're right, so not a good week for karaoke. This is a good week for the Beatles, pretty much. That's the sound of the people stuck at Newark in New Jersey, where the flights were canceled for almost 7 hours while they looked into the security breach when the guy walked through the wrong gate.
And
while
so,
they were
somebody,
waiting,
right,
yeah,
so
Josh Wilson had his guitar with him. He led everyone in a sing-along, and they picked Hey Jude. You know, not... not one of the Beatles' most peppy.
From holiday airport misery comes a triumph, at least according to the Week magazine.
I got to say, I'm surprised at how many of them were in tune. You don't always get that when people sing in an airport.
That's true. And there is no sort of tune-up app on YouTube that will tune you up before you upload.
You can't digitally fix it.
It's safe to say that this list of Good Week, Bad Week was made before Conan O'Brien learned that maybe he's moving
out. I think that's a safe bet.
We'll have to see what it is next week.
If you have nominations for who had a good week or a bad week, you can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also see the full Good Week, Bad Week feature in The Week magazine. It's on newsstands and online today.
And you can nominate yourself for Good Week and Bad Week. We had a pretty good week this week.
I had a pretty good week.
Coming up, we talk with former House Speaker Newt Gingrich about Obama's speech on security and his personal quest for transparent health care negotiations. He's also going to talk about Barack Obama's management style and whether it's even possible to move the national security bureaucracy in this day and age. Newt Gingrich coming up.
Keep the conversation going with your thoughts. Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, what would Newt Gingrich do? Is the Obama administration any better at handling the national security establishment than the Bush administration was? We're going to talk with the former Speaker of the House in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 31 minutes after the hour. December unemployment rate stands at 10%, unchanged from a month before. Economists were suspecting that it might rise a little bit, but it didn't. And we're looking at those statistics just released from the Labor Department seconds ago. Non-farm payrolls declining by 85,000. Speaking yesterday, President Obama ordered intelligence agencies to do a better job after a report into the attempted Christmas Day terror attack highlighted a series of intelligence failures. The president described the conflict with al-Qaeda as, quote, war, and said the U.S. needs to work harder to make its message clear.
We must communicate clearly to Muslims around the world that al-Qaeda offers nothing except a bankrupt vision of misery and death, including the murder of fellow Muslims, while the United States stands with those who seek justice and progress.
Meanwhile, the Nigerian man charged with attempting to blow up the flight from Amsterdam to Detroit is due to appear in court later today. Experts say that given the evidence, his lawyers won't have many options for defending the man.
In entertainment news, a source says NBC may reinstate Jay Leno to his slot in late night as host of The Tonight Show. A few moments ago, we spoke to Bill Carter, a media correspondent for our partner, The New York Times.
I think Jay might be a little bit happy. He's going back to the time period where he was a winner from a time period where he's been a loser.
That move would be in response to disappointing ratings for Leno's new primetime show. The markets, Dow gets underway at 10,606. The S&P opens at 1,141. And the NASDAQ will start at 2,300 even. Those are some of the stories we're looking at this morning.
Ultimately, the buck stops with me. As president, I have a solemn responsibility to protect our nation and our people. And when the system fails, it is my responsibility.
And there was President Obama, of course, at the White House yesterday, taking responsibility for the systemic security failures that allowed an attempted terror attack on Christmas morning. The event came complete with contrite government officials, a dour commander-in-chief, and an attempt to convey with real declassified documents the inner workings and inner screw-ups of a vast national security establishment. We turn now to former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. And Speaker Gingrich, good morning, first of all.
Good morning.
You know, we've talked with you on a couple of occasions about Obama's visionary oratory, but here you've got a president attempting to project that he's managing the crisis, controlling the federal bureaucracy, and this is something you've written about and experienced firsthand. As an example of projecting this president in control management thing, how do you think Obama did?
Well, I think he set the stage for a very dramatic change if he follows through on his words. This is the first time I can remember the president being very explicit, saying, quote, we are at war with al-Qaeda. Now, remember, this administration, after the last year, tried to avoid the word war, dropped the term war on terror, talked about overseas operations. If they take seriously that we are, again, the president's words, at war with al-Qaeda, the first thing they'll do is take the Nigerian bomber out of civilian courts and put them back under military custody so that the bomber can be interrogated in order to understand what his various connections were in Yemen and in the Netherlands. and in Nigeria. It's extraordinarily counterproductive to read a terrorist their Miranda rights and give them a lawyer who promptly tells them not to talk.
But are you saying that the fact that this individual from Nigeria is in civilian court right now, it means that the administration probably has had no interrogation with him whatsoever? I kind of doubt that.
We know for a fact that that the minute that he was talking until his lawyer walked in, because people in the administration have said so.
Right.
We know that the best totally lame, pathetic excuse the White House counterterrorism advisor could offer on Sunday on TV shows was that they would be plea bargaining with him. And as former Attorney General Mukasey in a brilliant article yesterday points out, having been Attorney General, what you want out of intelligence is speed. You want to know today everything that this young bomber knows so you can go after the bad guys in Yemen and Holland and Nigeria today. And a lot of that information loses its value every 24 or 48 hours that goes by. And Mukasey makes the point, as a former Attorney General.
Right, sure.
If you go through the plea bargaining process, that takes so long. Remember, it's the government lawyer talking to the private defense attorney, who then talks to the prisoner, who then comes back to the government attorney. I mean, this is the opposite, and this is why I'm intrigued with the president's deliberate use of the words "we are at war."
Well, if
he means it, he'll also drop the civilian trials in New York City.
Well, I guess
the terrorists.
We'll have to see what happens there. But in some sense, the president is hamstrung by the fact that this plane landed in Detroit on U.S. territory, and this individual does have a visa.
No, it's not. There are no provisions. The Supreme Court's been quite clear on this. There are no provisions that block the government, and the Obama administration has issued regulations on this. There are no provisions that block the government from treating an enemy combatant as an enemy combatant, whatever soil they happen to be on.
But Speaker Gingrich, I'm not going to go constitutional law head-to-head with you, but I don't think it's the case that the federal government has no restrictions on its ability to declare someone an enemy combatant willy-nilly if they're on American soil with a valid U.S. visa.
Yeah, of course there is. In 1942, when the German saboteurs were landed from submarines and were arrested by the FBI within 2 weeks.
They didn't have visas.
But President Franklin Delano Roosevelt said to the Attorney General, they will be tried within 6 weeks, they will be executed, and you will privately tell the Supreme Court I will not honor a writ of habeas corpus, and they should not issue one.
All right.
He said, I am the commander-in-chief in a nation at war.
All right.
Now, if the president is serious in what he said yesterday, and he believes we are at war, then he has to change the policies of the Justice Department. He has to change many of the whole attitude that has been up there that has, frankly, favored terrorist rights over the safety of Americans. And I don't think this has been deliberate in the sense that they sit around and say, oh, gosh, let us put Americans at risk. But the consequence of treating enemies in a war as though they are American civilians in a criminal court is to dramatically increase the danger to the United States.
Okay, all right, well, let's just encapsulate that in a takeaway. You are suggesting that the possibility when Obama says we are at war with al-Qaeda is a signal that the war nomenclature may be used as a justification to change this Nigerian's status in U.S. courts. Let's just leave that there for a moment. That's a really interesting proposition, and we will take a look at that
But let me give you one more example of the extension of this concept of war. If you think we're dealing with terrorists rather than American citizens, you don't need what the White House counsel said on Sunday was, quote, a smoking gun. I mean, a smoking gun implies that the would-be terrorist has to have done something beyond reasonable doubt as though it was a civilian court. You know, if somebody's father calls the American embassy and says, you know, my son's gone a little whacked out, and I think he's in Yemen getting terrorist training. You shouldn't need 7 corroborating pieces of information.
No, understood. And that was, gone over at the White House yesterday. Quickly, this was the first test of the redesigned national security establishment that took place during the Bush administration.
And it failed.
What do you think about that?
I think it means they better rethink how it operates.
And so a single top-down bureaucracy on national security is more difficult to control than what we had before 9/11?
No, it is because what we had before 9/11 failed, too. I mean, we have to understand how hard and how difficult this war is going to be, that it is a real war, and that our enemies would like to kill us. and we better move at the speed necessary to stop them from doing it.
Former Speaker of the House of Representatives talking about President Obama's performance yesterday at the White House. Thank you, Newt Gingrich. Coming up, we talk movies every Friday and which movies really speak teen nowadays. What do you think?
You just don't belong in my world, Bella.
I belong with you.
Yes, the vampires of the 21st century, movies and everything this weekend, later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. If you listened during Christmas week, you might have heard the conversation with Majid Mughni. He's an attorney in Dearborn, Michigan, organizing a rally for fellow Muslims that happens today. They're planning to speak out against terrorism. They're demonstrating against terrorists and the extremist angle in the Muslim religion. Mughni started organizing that after a failed Christmas Day attack aboard a Detroit-bound jet. Welcome back, Majid Mughni.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Your rally is planned for today?
Yes, it is. We are very excited to be out there today. We have a lot of snow on the ground. It's cold out there, but we're ready. We want to send a message to the world. We want the world to know that we're going to come out to battle. We're going to battle these terrorists. Battle them where they came. They came into our backyards, and we're ready. We're ready to take them on.
How many people? You've organized this over social media sites online. How many people are you planning to be there in Dearborn?
We're going to expect thousands of people. There's so much excitement in the community. This is the talk of the town. In one of the communities, one of the Yemeni communities, 120 community leaders came to their meetings, and they're going to be bringing people out tomorrow. Today. We have people coming from all around Southeast Michigan.
You're talking about the Yemeni community there, which is actually quite large in Dearborn. What is their response? What message are they trying to convey?
They have it front page news in their newspaper. They want their people to come out. They're gonna call it on Friday prayer. They are very, very excited to be a part of this event. They want to show the world that we're on America's side. This war is not a war against Islam. This war is Islam and the world against these terrorists. We're on the same side. We are getting attacked by these terrorists. They are attacking the religion of Islam, and they are attacking Muslims.
So I assume that this demonstration, part of it is born out of your frustration that there has been no real active response from moderate Muslims in the past.
Not just that, but this terrorist was going to blow an airplane right over the heads of the largest Muslim community in North America. He literally fell into our backyards, and now the natives have him. He's in our hands. And we're going to let them have it.
Okay, so what do you feel about some of the responses from the government in terms of handling this security problem, specifically the plan to profile people traveling from 14 countries, including Yemen?
Anything to make us safe is the right thing to do. On that airline that was going to be blown away, there was 20% of the passengers were Muslim. So it could have been somebody that I knew. It could have been my family on the airline. So whatever it takes to make Americans safe, we're Americans too.
Majid, you know, the Speaker of the House, former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, just suggested that this defendant should be declared an enemy combatant and his judicial rights be stripped to get information about terrorism. Would you go along with that?
You know, basically the message we want to send to the world is we want to ignite a movement. This is what we're doing here. We want to ignite a movement throughout the Muslim world, a movement that will drive Muslims. We'll drive Muslims to the streets and unite Muslims against these terrorists. A movement where all Muslims will rise together against terrorism, where they will follow these radicals into their homes, into the schools, into the mosques, and we will get rid of these radicals. And we hope that this following will really shake the foundation of these terrorists.
Okay, well, good luck. I hope that you handle the weather. It is going to be a cold day in Dearborn with snow. Majid Mughni, attorney in Dearborn, Michigan, organizing a peaceful demonstration against the radicalization of Islam.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, movies every Friday, and we're going to have a big discussion on what teens see in movies. We're going to have an expert, and also Rafer Guzman will be here. And here's your trivia question to ponder in honor of that discussion. Name a movie where it was the kid who won an Oscar, okay? There's only about three answers. Think hard now. And just for laughs, what's the highest grossing movie with a child as a star? That should be easy. You know how to reach us, 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. Latest jobless numbers are out. Employers shed 85,000 jobs last month, but the employment rate remains flat at 10%. University of Maryland economist Peter Morici, does that mean 10% is the bottom on the unemployment rate?
Not unless you want everybody to leave the country. 843,000 people net left the labor force, quit looking for work. But for that, the unemployment rate would have risen to 10.4%. This report is a disaster for the Obama administration.
And that's why the futures are way, way down. The markets seem to be reacting negatively to it. What's the trend from here on out? Just
the
more discouraged?
The trend has been a declining and shrinking private sector. At some point, that will end. But clearly, the stimulus package, the health care bill, and all the rest are not causing the private sector to grow again. The economy is not coming out. We're in real trouble.
Looking deep into the numbers for us, as always, thank you, Peter Morici, economist at the University of Maryland. Thanks so much.
Later today, a court in Detroit will get their first sight of the Nigerian man charged with attempting to blow up the U.S. jet on Christmas Day. Earlier in the program, we spoke to someone who's seen the suspect face-to-face. Heba Arif was on the same flight.
He looked really young, and he had this blank stare on his face. No reaction, no struggle, no nothing, no emotion, nothing.
Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Well, the studios take a breath this time of year in January. Slim pickings in the movies. Not a whole lot comes out this weekend, but there are things worth seeing, and we're going to talk about them with Rafer Guzman, who's out on the West Coast on vacation, takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday. Good morning, Rafer.
Good morning. How are you?
First of all, what are you excited about this weekend?
I'm most excited about actually is Daybreakers with Ethan Hawke and Willem Dafoe. Yet another vampire movie, but I actually enjoyed it quite a bit.
Really? And you know, this is a great cast, and it looks like just a gore flick, but you say it's bigger than that.
Well, I don't know if I'd say it's bigger than that, but it's at least kind of a fun take on the whole vampire myth. It takes place in the future. Vampires are now dominating society, and they're farming humans for their blood. And, of course, the supply is running low, and it's up to Ethan Hawke to try and find a blood substitute. Mm. And, of course, he winds up getting involved with a gang of rogue humans and, upturning all of society.
Sounds like Matrix meets Twilight. I love that.
It's Matrix meets Gattaca, if you remember the old Ethan Hawke.
Sure, and Ethan Hawke was in that, absolutely. Now, there's some youth-oriented movies coming out. Leap Year, starring Amy Adams, that comes out this weekend. It's another one of these movies where a young woman takes matters into her own hands, a la Juno, but in this case, she follows her boyfriend to Ireland to propose and then meets another guy. Uh-oh. And then there's A Youth in Revolt. Let's play a clip.
My name is Nick. I live with my charming mother. Her latest boyfriend, Jerry, is a pathological liar.
If a woman answered the phone, it was probably just a maid.
He's a real prize. My dad is currently in between jobs. Lacey is dad's girlfriend.
Baby, come here, you.
It's amazing how much action everyone around me seems to be getting. With one exception.
And the exception, of course, Michael Cera there in Youth in Revolt. This is becoming a bit of a character part for Michael Cera, Rafer.
Yeah, you think? He's played this quite a bit. Nick Norris is in The Playlist and also in Superbad and in Juno. I mean, he's very good at that kind of thing, the stuttering, stammering, super sensitive youth. It's hard to dislike him, and he's kind of good in this movie, as he always is.
And you liked it?
I liked it okay. I think it's an interesting film because it kind of does capture the way that adolescents are, perpetually confused for all those years in high school. They're kind of always going through a personality crisis. And in this movie, Michael Cera essentially invents an alter ego for himself named Francois Dillinger, who's, chain smokes and has an ascot and little pencil thin mustache. And he tries to be a bad boy so he can woo a girl. And the premise is kind of appealing because who what guy hasn't felt like developing some sort of
kick-ass persona like that.
Well, exploring the psyche of teens is nothing new for Hollywood. I mean, you've got an enormous range if you go throughout the history of Hollywood, and we're just scratching the surface here. Listen to this.
Did y'all hear the shooting last night?
Yeah, I heard it. I got on my bed.
Man, you a scary cat. My mama say, a bullet don't have no name on it.
That's from Boys in the Hood, and then a very different view of teen life from this movie, Breakfast Club.
If Ryan came walking up to you in the hall on Monday, what would you do? I mean, picture this, you're there with all the sports. I know exactly what you'd do. You'd say hi to him, and when he left, you'd cut him all up so your friends wouldn't think that you really liked him.
No way.
Okay. What if I came up to you? Same exact thing.
Molly Ringwald, Ali Sheedy there in the John Hughes classic, The Breakfast Club. So, Rafer, hold on there for a second. We're going to bring Nicole Caravo into this discussion. You're a 16-year-old from Long Island. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
What do you think of how the movies portray teens today? We played a couple of examples from long ago, and we can go back to Shirley Temple, someone who you might have seen in the Smithsonian as a teenager. But what do you think about how teens are portrayed today?
I feel like a lot of movies aren't, like, really true about how teenagers act. Like, high schools don't really have social groups. Like, say, a jock and a nerd would be friends. They wouldn't, like, be mean to the person. They wouldn't put them in garbage cans outside of school. None of that would really happen.
That's good to know. Society has advanced since my day. Do you like movies like Mean Girls?
Yeah, Mean Girls is actually one of my favorite movies.
Really?
Yeah.
See, my wife hates Mean Girls, doesn't want my 11-year-olds to see it at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah, isn't that funny?
It's actually a good movie. I mean, none of it's true. Obviously, you don't have people dominating the school. You don't have four girls doing that. But it's just a funny movie to watch, really. I mean, it's nothing true, but it's just funny.
Now, I'll tell you, my girls do love Twilight. Are you a Twilight fan?
Honestly, I'm not a big Twilight fan. I'm not big on the vampires. But, I mean, I heard it was good. I mean, I really haven't seen it, so I can't say anything about that. But I actually did see New Moon. Some of the things in there were some of the teenage things that they did were true, but most of it's like not.
Yeah, well, you know, you don't look for reality in the movies, but you do look for something that resonates, that's for sure. Rafer, what do you think about how teens are portrayed these days based on your long experience? What are you, pushing 40 right now?
I've already pushed 40. You know, it's interesting. You play the clip from The Breakfast Club, which, you know, to me was sort of the pinnacle of the teen movie, at least for my generation. I think, For the large part, teenagers, I think ever since the OC, the TV series, somehow Hollywood has gotten teenagers to be these impossibly self-possessed, smart, witty, you know, casual characters who just, they seem to approach everything with this degree of self-confidence, whether it's sexuality or relationships or whatnot.
Yeah,
I certainly never had that when I was in high school.
Indeed.
But maybe teenagers have changed.
All right, Rafer Guzman, takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday, and Nicole Caravo, 16-year-old from Long Island. It's trivia time now, guys. All right, ready? Name a movie where it was the kid who won an Oscar. About three answers. Rafer?
I'm going to take a couple stabs.
Quickly.
Paper Moon.
Got it.
And Good Ship Lollipop.
Ooh, nice. There was also The Piano and Miracle Worker with Patty Duke. And does anyone know the highest grossing kid actor movie of all time?
Is it The Champ?
No.
No.
Home Alone, guys.
Home Alone.
You can't be too careful when it involves underwear.
The very young Macaulay Culkin there as Kevin in the 1990 film Home Alone. Rafer Guzman, takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much. And Nicole Caravo, very self-possessed,
absolutely,
confident 16-year-old movie fan from Long Island. Thanks to everyone. And congrats to Teresa, who emailed and got the answer right. Anna Paquin in The Piano and Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon.
And the honorary Oscar that we slightly mentioned went to, of course, Shirley Temple, that
yes,
you said is now
in
the
Smithsonian. It was a lifetime achievement.
Right. If you can reach us, not just for movie trivia, of course, but anything that you hear in the news, anything that's on your mind, we want to hear from you. One question we have for you today, with airplane security on our minds and in the news, how do you think we can make the skies safer? Is passenger profiling the answer? And if it is, who should be profiled? Let us know. You can send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org or on our Facebook page. Our phone lines are down at the moment, so emailing us is the best way to reach us this morning.
Somebody
or Twitter.
Emailed on the trivia question. Somebody said Jodie Foster for Taxi Driver. Good guess.
Good
but
guess,
no,
but
she was
didn't
nominated.
Win.
She didn't win.
Yeah,
that's
she
right,
did
that's
not
right.
win.
Right.
If you missed anything, we are always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast. You can subscribe at iTunes, also at thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
So another month, another unemployment rate number. We're at 10% in December. Big number, but it's just one. Kind of like looking at the U.S. economy from 50,000 feet up. You got your jobs lost, jobs found. You know, what if you could watch a recession unfolding in real, no, speeded up time? What would you be able to see? The View from Mount Recession, economics with special effects, coming up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, January 8th, and The Takeaway is, what does the economy look like if you could see a recession spreading month by month? A discussion with someone who literally made an animated movie out of recession data from 2007 until just last year.
Well, I'll tell you what I thought it looked like when looking at that map they made. It looked like the spread of a virus. But let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Job news just out. The unemployment rate was unchanged in December at 10%. The Labor Department says employers cut 85,000 jobs last month. That's worse than the 8,000 drop that analysts expected. That signals that the economy hasn't recovered enough to revive hiring.
So, Chris Wilson, associate editor at Slate, you're going to have to update your fancy interactive recession map, huh?
Yeah, I sure will.
And any surprises that you found by creating this interactive sort of flash forward in time map that shows the growth of the recession from 2007 until October?
Well, you know, I think Celeste really hit the nail on the head when she said that it does resemble kind of the spread of a virus. And, you know, I think that is because, you know, economies are kind of local. And if, you know, a factory shuts down one place, it sort of spreads out until, you know, unfortunately, it affects the entire country.
Any sign, and I guess we will know when the statistic comes out later this morning, that, you know, a cure is in the future?
You know, I think pretty much any economist will tell you that employment figures are a lagging indicator. So we probably will not see good news in the next couple of months, even if, you know, other things like manufacturing are kind of showing, you know, what Washington calls green shoots.
Well, on Chris Wilson's map, those green shoots are actually colored blue. Stay with us, Chris. We'll be back with you in just a moment to talk about all sorts of economic indicators.
There's been various Republican reactions to President Obama's speech yesterday about intelligence failures over the Christmas attempted plane attack. Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, speaking on ABC's Good Morning America, said President Obama turned the corner on understanding terrorism when he publicly declared the U.S. was at war with Al-Qaeda. He said the president must stay on a war footing. It's also a line taken by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, he said the government needs to take the Nigerian suspect out of civilian court and put him in military custody.
What you want out of intelligence is speed. You want to know today everything that this young bomber knows.
Well, that Nigerian man will make his first court appearance today. Experts say it will be hard for lawyers to defend him because the evidence is pretty much stacked against him. We also heard earlier from Emil Snakle, former senior intelligence officer with the CIA. He said there were several intelligence failures that federal review identified.
We had underestimated Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's not only intent, but operational capability.
The Turkish wife of the man who killed seven CIA employees in Afghanistan says her husband hated the United States. She tells the Associated Press her husband was especially outraged at the U.S.-led invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan.
So let's look at the markets. They're reacting to the unemployment numbers. Asian markets ended up slightly. European markets edged higher. Gold is trading at $1,121 an ounce. The Dow gets underway at 10,606, and the futures, after being positive most of the morning, have really shifted negative since the Labor Department number. The S&P opens at 11. 741, and the NASDAQ opens at 2300.
It's been 20 years, but they've barely aged a bit.
We're
going to talk about the 20th anniversary of The Simpsons with Mr. Burns, Ned Flanders, one of the voices behind the show,
Harry
Shearer.
We got all those people. We booked them all?
All of them, actually. And we're asking you whether or not what you think about airline security. Let us know at our email. Coming up, unemployment is just a number. What parts of the country they're facing the worst? We'll talk about that.
Hey, neighbor, this is Nettie Flanders, and all across America, you're listening to The Takeaway, even in Springfield.
Good morning, everyone. First Friday of January, and the latest jobless numbers show that the unemployment rate remained the same in December at 10%. The economy lost 85,000 jobs. And, you know, every time we see these numbers, I think, you know, radio is at a terrible disadvantage. We can't spread data out and represent it visually in the same way that you can do on television or on a computer screen.
That's right.
And digitally, you can even make it really, really interactive. We were talking to Chris earlier, but we're going to push the envelope here in radio. I mean, what if, okay, you could take all that economic data and go back in time, say in some kind of a crazy big picture mobile that can see the U.S. economy from way above and then travel forward in time and watch what's happened since the year 2007. Celeste, here we go. All right. Nice view from up here. And you can see down there the economy is booming. California, nothing the matter with Kansas over there. Whoa, check out Florida. But then the good times start to change. It's subtle at first. 2008, you can hear the sound of job losses. And as the months pass, the job losses accelerate until it's really a din. Los Angeles, look at that. Miami crashes, and yikes, Detroit, lots of turbulence over there. Come on, let's steer clear. There were some safe places, like Riley County, Kansas. But mostly, unemployment rising, county by county, state by state. Wait a minute, how's Riley doing? What's their secret? But in general, it's recession, Category 5, as we get farther into 2009. Yet, still, on the horizon, you could begin to see something else. Job creation. Slow but steady. That's a much more pleasant sound. Hey, let's land this baby and find out what it all means. That's right. What does it all mean? Chris Wilson is an associate editor at Slate.com. He processed thousands of pieces of unemployment data and created a dynamic map that we've attempted to simulate in radio. Poorly, I know. But it shows unemployment county by county, month by month, since January 2007. You can go to Slate.com and see how the recession proceeded. First of all, please excuse us for our radio indulgence there. But do you hear anything that corresponds to what you saw on your map?
I was going to ask if you could send me those airplane sounds after this interview.
No problem, buddy.
It really is, as you were saying, there's a very dramatic point in very late 2008 or early 2009 where, you know, you go from what looks like, you know, as you say, maybe a Category 1 hurricane to real disaster.
And you can see it on the map. I mean, I urge people to go there. Blue is the job creation, and red is the job losses. And you really do see that in a period of months, really weeks, the economy goes from all blue to basically all red with a couple of points of safety in it. Did that surprise you? What does it say about the data when you can look at it in this different digitally sort of remastered way?
Well, you know, I mean, the first thing that it tells you is simply that, you know, this does not strike the country uniformly.
Right.
If you go back to the very, very first data set that we found, it was January 2007, you already see that Oakland County in Michigan is in the red. They were sort of patient zero, if you want to think of this as a sort of an epidemic. And then, you know, as you go along, you see that places particularly that, you know, had particularly bad kind of housing situations start going into the red earlier, and then, you know, as we were saying, by early 2009, it is really pretty difficult to find a pretty picture anywhere.
Well, you know, Chris Wilson, and again, you're the one who designed this map, associate editor at Slate.com. Looking at the data like this, and we were kicking around here at the Takeaway, it creates different kinds of questions. For instance, what the heck is going on in Riley County, Kansas? Michael Kearns, Riley County Commissioner in Kansas, looking at this map, you've had a pretty good ride since 2007. Michael, good morning, and what's your secret?
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me on. Secret, I think, are two things. One, we have a large military installation right on our west border, Fort Riley, Kansas. And the other is we're a university town. We have Kansas State University here. And that has about 22,000 students at it, 6,000 professors or employees, and out at post. At Fort Riley, there's about 16,000 soldiers assigned there. They're not all there at one time because they deploy over to Afghanistan or wherever they happen to be.
Would you say that you're recession-proof in Riley County?
I wouldn't say recession-proof. No, I don't think, that's like saying never. But we certainly do have a good, a good buttress against it with that.
Right.
With that mix of the post and the university.
All right. Well, the data point, Michael Kearns, Riley County Commissioner in Kansas, showing where the recession has been really pretty moderate. But we go to another data point. Ned Murray, Associate Director of the Florida International University Metropolitan Center. Ned, I suspect if we were to find you on Chris Wilson's map, you'd be deep in a red puddle there in South Florida, right?
Yes, good morning. And we've been getting redder by the month, unfortunately. For South Florida and Florida in general, you really have to look at it from a chronological perspective. If you go back to the early part of the decade through 2005, what you'll find is that Florida had the fastest job growth rate and the lowest unemployment rate among the 10 most populous states in the country, with a 3.6 unemployment rate in 2005.
Wow.
It was just about that time that the bubble burst, and of course, we saw the first ripple effect through the economy in terms of construction job loss and the fire industries, finance, insurance, real estate, and then, of course, food and accommodation, services and retail all subsequently have also been impacted over the last couple of years. So we were at 3.5, 3.6 a couple of years ago. We're now at, the state, 11.5, and here in South Florida we're averaging roughly, between 10 and 11%, depending on which county.
3.6 to more than 11% unemployment. That is quite a change. Ned Murray is Associate Director of the Florida International University Metropolitan Center, a data point down there in South Florida. Thanks so much to you, and also to Michael Kearns, Riley County Commissioner in Riley, Kansas, the sort of happier data point on Chris Wilson's map. Chris Wilson's interactive map on the unemployment and the recession since 2007 is available at Slate.com, where Chris Wilson is an associate editor. You can look at Chris Wilson's dynamic map by going to our website, thetakeaway.org, or at slate.com. And now at just about 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at some of the headlines we're following.
As we've been saying, new unemployment numbers came out in the last hour. Some 85,000 people lost their jobs, but the national unemployment rate stayed the same. Earlier in the show, we got reaction from economist Peter Morici, who said this is bad news for the Obama administration.
Clearly, the stimulus package, the health care bill, and all the rest are not causing the private sector to grow again. The economy is not coming out. We're in real trouble.
Later today, a court in Detroit will get their first sight of the Nigerian man charged with attempting to blow up the U.S. jet on Christmas Day. This comes a day after the president emphasized the need to send out a clear message on where the U.S. stands in what he called this war against al-Qaeda.
We must communicate clearly to Muslims around the world that al-Qaeda offers nothing except a bankrupt vision of misery and death, including the murder of fellow Muslims, while the United States stands with those who seek justice and progress.
In college football, big story last night, the BCS, the so-called Rose Bowl, the bowl championship series. Alabama won its first national title in nearly two decades. The Crimson Tide scored a 37-21 victory over Texas in the game in Pasadena, California. Here's some economic news that we'll be chewing over for perhaps the next century. China says it's overtaken Germany to become the world's largest exporter. Data released in Frankfurt shows Germany exporting $150 billion worth of goods in the first 11 7 months of last year. That's $20 billion short of China's reported figures. In weather news, one resident in North Dakota says the minus 50 wind chill makes breathing painful and, quote, freezes your nostrils. The storm that's been causing all the havoc is pushing east. It's a little milder in the east after dumping several inches of snow in parts of the nation's midsection.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're going to check back in with The Waiting Room. That's a project that documents the hospital waiting room in Oakland, California, and we get to listen in on what folks are saying there as they wait to see the doctor.
Hey, you want that to go?
Big takeouts this morning. Of course, the big story yesterday at the White House, the president at the news conference talking about all the national security details in the wake of the Christmas attack on that plane over Detroit. And, you know, before Christmas, most of us didn't even know who John Brennan was, the counterterrorism czar in the Homeland Security Department. But yesterday at the White House, it was mea culpa.
I told the president today I let him down. I am the president's assistant for Homeland Security and counterterrorism. And I told him that I will do better, and we will do better as a team.
And will he be a part of that team, I guess, is my first question to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, who was there at that news conference.
Yeah, it was my first question, too. Anytime a high official like John Brennan, the president's advisor on national security and Homeland Security, says, Mr. President, I let you down, the question has to be, did you offer your resignation?
Well, generally, what did you feel about this? There were reactions to the operational readiness of al-Qaeda, which kind of surprised me. What was your impression?
You know, the national security advisor, James Jones, has said in the run-up to this, the public is going to have some shock when they read this report. Janet Napolitano of Homeland Security and Brennan were both asked, what shocked you? And Brennan said that they were surprised that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was operationally able to mount an attack like this one over Detroit. And that was shocking to me because this group had used an undergarment bomb to try to assassinate a Saudi official not very long ago. They mounted attacks like this before. Janet Napolitano said that they were surprised that lone actor terrorists were a threat to the United States or could be instead of a broader conspiracy like 9/11. And that shocked me because lone actor terrorists operate all over the world, in the Middle East, in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Iraq,
we see them all the time. Iraq. So it was surprising to me that they weren't geared up for that. That's what shocked me.
Surprising surprises there at the White House from Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick.
I've never really thought about health plan until I got sick.
I'm basically retired. I have very little income. And suddenly I have some health problems.
A lot of people that need help like me. I'm not the only one. Everybody here needs help or they wouldn't be here.
Some people would say what I'm saying is making a lot of sense. A lot of other people would say he's only saying that because he ain't got the money.
We've been dropping in on conversations like that document life in the waiting room of Highland Hospital. That's a county facility in Oakland, California. It's all thanks to a project called The Waiting Room. It's a film project, a web project, and a social media project, actually. Our latest installment introduces us to Lois Ruther Evert. She has health insurance, and she really only has to wait about an hour or less to see a doctor, but her boyfriend is uninsured, and he waits a lot longer.
You can sit in the emergency room for 8 hours here at Highland. You really can. For 8 hours to see a doctor here at Highland. So that should be significant enough to say that, you know, we need three, four, because maybe there's not enough doctors, or maybe there's just too many patients. Because employees don't offer health care to the employees because they can't afford it, and so therefore the employees come here, you know, places like Highland Hospital for their primary care, dental, vision, you know, and things like that. So we do need major health care reform.
But Lois Ruther Evert sees that graphically because she sees the difference between herself having health insurance and her boyfriend that she has to sit and wait with, who's uninsured.
Well, I've said it before. The premise of this waiting room project is kind of like that Project StoryCorps, except the stories in this case come out of a waiting room in Oakland, California, where people talk passionately and in some ways emotionally about their needs for health care. So you most recently lived in Detroit.
Right.
I actually grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, along with the Reverend Al Green. There's an Al Green cut. And Al Green, an absolute genius. But the genius behind Al Green was Willie Mitchell, jazz musician, arranger, jazz trumpeter, producer. He died this week at the age of 81, and he launched the career of Al Green, along with many other soul performers in the 1970s. Here to talk about what his legacy is, Willie Mitchell's, is Gabriel Roth, owner of Daptone Records, joins us from Brooklyn. Gabriel Roth, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
It's great to be with you. And, you know, Al Green has a lot to thank Willie Mitchell for. And I'm wondering what we all, as, you know, lovers of soul music, have to thank Willie Mitchell for. You met him.
Yeah, I did. You know, Willie Mitchell is definitely one of those unsung heroes of soul music that really has legendary status among a lot of musicians and producers, but other people may not know who he is. He had a very unique sound, a very unique arranging sound and recording style. He was an engineer, an arranger, a songwriter. He wrote You Ought to Be With Me and Let's Stay Together with Al Green, co-wrote those and many other songs. You know, for decades he was producing records, great records, and you know, other than the Al Green records, there's also, you know, the Ann Peebles records, right, Phil Johnson records, Ovie Wright, Otis Clay, and all those records. I think when you listen to them alongside the Al Green records, I think a lot of the sound that you may, a lot of people may mistake for a distinctly Al Green type of sound, is actually coming from Willie Mitchell.
It's a Willie Mitchell sound. Yeah, I mean, is he a model for you as a producer, a real hands-on musician's musician, a producer and arranger?
He really is. He's a real inspiration for me, just because he was doing everything. He was arranging and producing and writing, and had a really unique sound. And when we did have that chance to meet him down in Memphis, he was very inspiring to me. I mean, I was just gushing. I was overwhelmed with questions for him about how he was miking drums and different singers and stuff. And he stopped me. He interrupted me, and he said, you know, the only thing you need to make great records are these and this. And he pointed to his ears, and he pointed to his heart, and that'll always stick with me.
That says it all. We'll miss him. Gabriel Roth certainly will miss him, the owner of Daptone Records, our guest. Thinking about Willie Mitchell, who died this week at the age of 81.
Good morning, Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we talked to a passenger who sat six rows in front of the bomber who on Christmas Day tried to blow up Northwest Airlines Flight 253, a Muslim woman who says she's been profiled in the past, but that incident may have changed her mind about profiling. Coming up in a moment, first here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. Later today, Detroit will be the scene for the first appearance in civilian court for the Nigerian suspect in the attempted Christmas terror attack. Speak on CBS's early show this morning, former Director of National Intelligence John Negroponte said he supports the steps the president is taking.
We are safer than we were before 9/11. This is a question of tweaking the system. We dodged a bullet, obviously. It was a near miss, but I think the president is taking appropriate prompt and corrective action.
Moving on to economic news, the nation's employers cut more jobs than expected last month. The Labor Department reports employers eliminated 85,000 positions. Still, the unemployment rate held steady at 10%. Gay rights advocates are vowing to fight back after New Jersey's Senate voted down a bill to legalize same-sex marriage. Activists say they'll file a lawsuit with the state's top court.
Back home at the College Football National Championships, Alabama clinched its first national title in nearly 20 years. The Crimson Tide scored a 37-21 victory over Texas in the game in Pasadena, California, that, you know, if you're as old as me, you might have called the Rose Bowl, you know, years and years ago, but it's all different
now.
Was
that long ago?
Yeah. Well, it's in the fine print that it's the Rose Bowl. Anyway, the markets are reacting to the unemployment news that Celeste mentioned, unchanged at 10% for December. The Dow is open and down about 26 points. So the S&P down about 3 points, and the NASDAQ down about 6.5 points. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
As we've been saying, today the Nigerian man who tried to blow up Northwest Flight 253 on Christmas Day will be arraigned in Detroit. Heba Araf will also be in the courtroom. Araf was a passenger on Flight 253, and before she boards another plane to return to her home in Kuwait, she wants to have a chance to see the man who could have ended her life. She joins us now. Good morning, Heba.
Good morning, Celeste. Good morning, John.
First of all, you sat six rows away from Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab. Can you just describe us, walk us through what happened on that flight? Did he distinguish himself at all before the incident occurred?
Sure. I was six rows in front of him. I did not see anything suspicious about him. I didn't really notice him while we were on the flight. Everything was going fine on the flight till the last about half hour when we were getting ready for landing. And that's when we heard this loud smacking noise, and I kind of just out of curiosity turned my head and kind of took a look at the overhead cabins to see if something had maybe fallen out or slammed shut or something. And the look on the flight attendant's face was kind of puzzled and alarmed. So within a few seconds, she was over in the aisle near where the suspect was sitting, and she started yelling, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" And a few people started to take note, and I unbuckled and turned around and looked over to see what was going on, and I saw from where he was sitting some smoke start to come up. My first thought was maybe someone was just trying to light a cigarette and couldn't wait till we landed or something. And then I saw this red flash or glow, kind of the way it would look when you light a flare. And then suddenly someone yelled fire, and at that point it just kind of turned into chaos. At that point I didn't see the suspect. I heard, from reports from other people that he was on fire himself, him and the pillow, and I didn't hear any yelling from him. I didn't hear him say a word. I think I would have. I heard a lot of people yelling for water, and so they were passing up their water bottles until finally someone, the flight attendant, well, it seemed like finally, I'm sure it was just a few seconds, the flight attendant brought up a fire extinguisher, and they put out the fire, thankfully.
So, Heba Araf, at what point did you realize this was an attempted terrorist attack?
It took me a really long time. I guess you don't really think of it as a reality until you're in the situation, but, it didn't really hit me until maybe I was in the airport or on my way home, but we were told on the flight that there was an incident where someone had tried to light some firecrackers, and that was the understanding, the initial understanding. I had thought, it was Christmas Day, maybe someone who had some mental issues was just trying to make a scene or celebrate or something. And then when I saw the Dutch passenger who was taking him up, escorting him up to the front, I saw the suspect at that point after he had already been constrained. And he looked really young, and he had this blank stare on his face, no reaction, no struggle, no nothing, no emotion, nothing. He was half naked from the bottom down. And I later learned that it was, in his underwear, and so they had to strip him at his seat. They took him up to the front, and they handcuffed him there. So, at that point, I just thought someone was, had some issues, was just trying to do
around.
Something harmful. And that's where it hit me that someone was actually trying to do something harmful when I saw them taking him up to the front.
You know, what's occurred later, all of the aftershocks of this attempted terrorist attack, and in terms of the new security measures, putting tighter restrictions on people coming from certain countries, that has real resonance from you. You are Muslim yourself.
Right.
And you've long been an opponent of racial profiling, and especially profiling of Muslims.
Yeah, and I still am an opponent of racial profiling. I think there are other security measures that could be put in place that I think would be a lot more effective and strategic and wise. I think racial profiling is going to cause a lot of problems. One, it doesn't work. It's ineffective. You can't racially profile Muslims. Islam is a religion. You can't look at someone and determine if they're Muslim or not. These 14 countries that are on the list, it's based on past experiences, but it doesn't take into consideration, God forbid, any future experiences or where, future terrorists might be from.
But
it just doesn't work. I think we have to apply these secure measures across the board to every passenger. That's the only way it'll work.
Well, so what? How can we do this? How can we narrow the field and narrow these watch lists to come up with a list of people who may be dangerous and may need further investigation?
I mean, the watch list, that's, you know, the Homeland Security and other security personnel can review and really look at who's on the list and who needs to be and who doesn't need to be. There are a lot of unnecessary people on the list, and that's why it makes it a lot harder to focus on the people that need to be on the list. And there are different levels of the list, and they should be treated accordingly. Personally, I think this individual was on, you know, he was on the watch list, but maybe he should have been on a higher level of the watch list. And even if he was on the lower level, then he should have been treated accordingly. I don't think he had any secondary searching or screening, and that was just, you know, irresponsible. But that doesn't mean there, you know, that just anyone from Nigeria or anyone who's Muslim should be treated that way as if they're on a watch list. Absolutely not. There are certain factors that lead to that situation or being on the list.
You probably have a different view of the issue, though, now that you experienced what you have.
No, I do have a different view, and possibly just heightening security generally to everyone, to all passengers who want to travel. I know it'll make it a little bit harder, but it's a lot safer. Putting in more body scanners, you know, I've seen machines that puff out the air to detect explosive, more air marshals, reviewing the watch list to determine really who needs to be on there and who doesn't. Really, it will help to get the support of the wider Muslim community in America, because, you know, they can do
a
lot
help.
To, you know, speak out and help and assist, you know, the government in rooting out these terrorists.
That's Heba Araf. She was a passenger on flight 253. She spoke to us from her home in Michigan. Coming up.
Who controls the British crown? Who keeps the metric system down?
The takeaway does. That's actually from The Simpsons. They're celebrating their 20th anniversary this week, and we're going to talk to the voice of a bunch of different Springfield residents. Harry Shearer joins us later this hour.
The electric car. Who makes the Doomberg a star?
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And consider the beleaguered music industry. I mean, how do you measure its success anymore? Stalked by dinosaurs like Napster, digital downloads. It's been in the doldrums for more than a decade. But let's look at it this year. Do you measure it by counting the hits? Jay-Z, Alicia Keys, that's, of course, Empire State of Mind, or hits like this.
Till I dream, he comes away.
She's more like a phenom, Susan Boyle is. That's I Dream a Dream. Or Taylor Swift, the latest young thing.
I'm in the room, it's a typical Tuesday night. I'm listening to the kind of music she does.
Taylor Swift, of course, You Belong With Me. Or maybe is a better measure this tune here.
Don't stop me.
That's Keisha, TikTok. It's a hit single, and it comes from a very, very different pathway to success. And here to talk about the measures of the music industry right now at this very difficult time is Mara Johnston, writer and music business columnist for DailyFinance.com. First of all, good morning.
Hello.
And Nielsen has rolled out a whole bunch of numbers that has really surprised the music industry, and it indicates to me that maybe there's a turn that's been made here, and the music industry is actually prepared for the 21st century all of a sudden. What do you think, Mara?
I think they might be. I think that, you know, overall, basically the numbers are that overall music sales were up. If you count individual tracks, they sold 1.5 billion tracks this year, and that's sort of a slight uptick from 2008. You know, the old sort of measure of music sales is the album,
right.
And album sales were down once again, this time 13% from between 2008 and 2009. But, you know, the last track that you played, the Kesha song, actually
right.
just sold 600,000 copies in a week, you know, which is a lot for a single artist.
And that's mostly digital, right?
It's all digital.
It's
yeah.
all digital. I mean, that's the interesting thing. And it's Kesha, right?
Kesha, yeah.
Kesha,
the
all right,
dollar
sorry.
Sign makes it makes the E short.
Such an over-the-hill radio host loser guy. You know, you can't talk to me. But how did this track become a hit? That's the interesting story.
Well, I think it's really interesting because Kesha is sort of this this personality as much as she is a pop artist. You know, she sort of is known for her outlandish antics, and her song is called TikTok, and it's written by this guy, Dr. Luke, who's written a bunch of other hits of recent vintage. But she's, you know, very outsized and very much about keeping her persona in the press as much as her music.
It's a Lady Gaga kind of modality, right?
Lady Gaga, yeah. Katy Perry, exactly, yeah, exactly. So, like, you know, that makes people remember who she is when they're maybe on the iTunes store and browsing for something to listen to.
Is this the new business model in music right now? It's the sale of a lifestyle, of a personality, as well as the actual music?
I think so. I think, you know, I think that that's a good way to cut through the clutter. I mean, I think that right now superstars are really hard to mint, and so getting people's just personas out there in any way is sort of an advantage for anyone trying to sort of break through the consciousness.
So the takeaway here is bad news again for the record companies, the old businesses, but good news for stars and DJs and personalities who want to make a splash digitally, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Mara Johnston is writer and music business columnist for DailyFinance.com. Thanks so much.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockamay. John, you like The Simpsons?
Love The Simpsons.
Because in just a few minutes, we are going to have on this show Ned Flanders.
Wow.
Mr. Burns, Smithers, whoa, Lenny Leonard, Principal Skinner, Auto Man.
Room in the studio here?
The voice behind all of those characters, Harry Shearer, will join us in just a minute. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Stocks are lower after new job numbers out this morning. The unemployment rate stayed flat at 10%. Employers cut 85,000 jobs in December. Analysts had expected around 8,000 jobs to go. The report signals that many jobless people are actually giving up on their search for work. President Obama will discuss the state of the labor market in his speech later today. UPS said this morning it will cut 1,800 jobs. That news is just out. Detroit's U.S. attorney says no plea deals have been offered to the suspected Christmas Day attacker who's preparing for his first court date. The Nigerian man is due in court this afternoon to be arraigned on 6 charges.
Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich said the administration should move that Nigerian suspect from civilian to military custody and treat him as an enemy combatant.
What you want out of intelligence is speed. You want to know today everything that this young bomber knows.
It's Newt Gingrich, former House Speaker, talking with us earlier. Finally, some school children in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New Jersey are getting the day off as a relentless snowstorm heads east. Officials are urging careful driving this morning. Those are some of the stories we're following.
Has it really been 20 years ago that this offbeat comedy animated show for adults debuted? It was an animated show for adults, remember? That wasn't common in those days.
Never make it.
It went up against a powerhouse, America's Funniest Home Videos and My Two Dads, and it became the first real super mega hit for the Fox network. The Simpsons turns 20 next week, and they haven't aged a bit. Quite literally. Who should we turn to reflect on these 20 years?
If any of you ever need a favor, just look for the happiest man in Springfield.
Turns out we do need a favor, actually. And if we need one, we should probably go straight to Ned Flanders, or at least the voice behind him. We'd love to talk with him now. Good morning, Harry Shearer.
Good morning from London.
Good morning. Well, 20 years since The Simpsons debuted, when you very first started this series, your picture of it must be vastly different than what it is now. From what I understand, when you very first started, you thought voice acting itself was not all that interesting.
Well, I felt that working in animation was normally a very industrial process where you came in and you did your lines sort of by yourself, and there wasn't that kind of working together with other actors that I liked in comedy. And The Simpsons was devised to work in that latter way, where we basically are getting together to do the equivalent of old radio shows. We do them together, and you know, then the animation proceeds based on our performances. So it's a very different process and a much more rewarding one. But I mean, you know, you look back on the days when we were starting, and the Fox network for the older folks in the audience, you may remember, was mainly on UHF channels, and you needed to attach a wire coat hanger to your TV to see it.
You know, some of these scenes where you're talking about having the actual live conversation between the characters, mm-hmm. some of those is probably just you in the room. I mean, you voice so many characters on this show that there's probably lots of scenes with yourself.
Yes, but it's also true of Dan Castellaneta, who plays both Homer and Homer's dad, or Hank, who plays both Moe and Chief Wiggum. So we're all accustomed to talking to ourselves, and you know, we do seek professional help when required.
Well, Harry, aside from the questions about your professional help, which I've always wanted to ask, I really want to ask you about this. You play, and this is not a comprehensive list, Mr. Burns, Smithers, Ned Flanders, Reverend Lovejoy, Kent Brockman, Dr. Hibbert, Lenny, Principal Skinner, Otto, Rainier, Wolfcastle. I mean, you have so many different characters, but they all kind of boil down to authority figures. Is that a fair assessment of who you play on The Simpsons?
Except for Scratchy.
Right.
Oh, yeah, right. There you go.
and I don't see Lenny as much of an authority
figure. Right, I suppose not.
Yeah.
But you are this kind of adult voice.
I think Carl sees him as an authority figure. I think that would be the limit of his authority. Yeah, I guess that is sort of my specialty, if there is one. Sure. I'll plead guilty to that.
You know, it's curious because you really started your career during the golden age, what people often refer to as the golden age of TV. You mentored under Mel Blanc. And, mm-hmm. and you know, in 1999, Time magazine called Simpsons the best television series of the 20th century. With your knowledge of what that actually includes, who was left out of that best slot, do you think that's accurate? Is The Simpsons the best TV series of the 20th century?
Well, knowing where my paychecks come from, absolutely.
Okay, but on the side, I won't tell anybody.
I certainly think that the Dick Van Dyke Show has to be put in anybody's reckoning of among the best television comedy shows of the 20th century. I wouldn't presume to talk about drama or other forms. But
there's a connection there, though, Harry. I mean, yeah. That's an ensemble show. That was really all about a comedy ensemble. And really,
right.
You know, that's carried forward in The Simpsons.
That's true, and you know, I think that that's reflected in you know when you have a really good comedy ensemble, I think you have the makings at least of a really excellent show. I'd say that torch has been carried in this century by the British comedy The Office, which to me is one of the best ensemble comedies ever as well.
You know, the Simpsons obviously was a game changing show and has certainly had an effect on American society, not alone entertainment. But you know, back in the early 2000s, I remember you saying that you felt the quality of the show was going down. And I have a quote from you in 2004 where you say you rate the last three seasons as among the worst. Has the picture changed since then?
That was a private email correspondence. It was never a public statement of mine. I think the show, like any long-running show, has had ups and downs, and I think you judge a show based on the overall batting average and not necessarily on its weakest points.
Well, but shows that hang around for a long time do have you know, sort of scenarios of going out. I mean, you've got the ER, which you're going out with a wedding. I mean, that's what all the networks do. They have a wedding at the end, or you've got Happy Days, which jump the shark.
Or you wake up and it's a dream. It was all a dream.
It was all a dream. That was Dallas. What's the jump the shark scenario for The Simpsons, do you think?
I think probably we go 3D.
I love it.
You know, which if you look at the CES show this week in Vegas, is probably where every show is going. But I think we'll get there first.
Which is your favorite voice? Do you have one?
Probably C. Montgomery Burns, because he represents pure evil, and you rarely get evil that pure. You know, evil people tend to make the mistake of diluting it, you know, from time to time. Well,
could we speak to Mr. Burns?
Oh, yes, you could. You can't afford him, but you can.
We can't afford him. So you're invoicing us now, Mr. Burns?
Oh, I'm invoicing you as I speak.
I'm wondering, what, Mr. Burns, what you think of the security measures that we have to put in place in order to avoid terrorist attacks on our in domestic flights.
I prefer a simpler form of security measure. I travel with my hounds.
Nice. Well, Harry Shearer, we should remind people that you are the host of Public Radio's Le Show, as well as being Mr. Burns, which, of course, I'm a big fan of.
Entering its 27th year.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's something that you've kept going, and that must be a labor of love for you.
That is indeed, yeah. Please give.
No, we've heard the last three seasons have really stunk on the Le Show, too.
Touché.
He's already designing his Jump the Shark episode of Le Show.
Right. I'm going HD radio with the show.
That is, of course, Harry Shearer, not only host of Le Show on Public Radio, he's also the voice of Mr. Burns, Smithers, Flanders, Principal Skinner, Reverend Lovejoy, Otto, tons of characters on The Simpsons. It turns 20 next week. Happy 20th anniversary, and thanks for joining us. I'm sure there's a lot of Simpsons out there listening right now, and we're wondering, what is your favorite line? Maybe it's an episode, or maybe there's a particular character that you identify with. Someone named M.L. Coney emails, Smithers, this isn't rocket science, it's brain surgery. Give me the ice cream scoop. Tell us your favorite.
Todd Zwillick had this suggestion that everyone's going to have a favorite Simpsons line. I think he's right. You can email us at myticket@takeaway.org.
You can also reach us not just for The Simpsons, but pretty much whatever else is on your mind or in the news. Here's one question for you today. We have airplane security on our minds, right? So in order to make the skies safe, do you think passenger profiling is the answer? And if so, who should be profiled? How do you improve security? Pat in New York writes us, the issue is training, not the vendors hawking the equipment, and the media discussing process and technology. That would be us, John. The prevention will occur with training, something for which there are no vendors, no sexy news stories, and no quick fix solution.
All right, Pat. Thank you. Message received. George heard the headline that the president is ordering more air marshals on planes. This is the dumbest idea I've ever heard, George writes. The person that had the bomb should not have been allowed on the plane in the first place. It was a failure of intel agencies. A sky marshal would not have prevented the bomb from going off had it not been faulty. Your takes, just email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we're always on here at the show. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
Hey, have a good weekend, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Hey, neighbor. This is Nandy Flanders. And all across America, you're listening to The Takeaway, even in Springfield.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.